and for the patience.
And lots of chalk on the board ledges as well.
Sure. Thank you for the chalk. I didn't mean to do it this way, but I've just sort of blown in here because the train was late. So I'm going to catch a breath as we start. What I'm going to talk to you about is quantum gravity and the basic ideas of the at least one, if not two, of the different approaches to the quantum theory of gravity. And I'm going to do it without transparency, so on the blackboard. So I start off by getting to erase this quote. The main thing to say about this for people, so first is the obvious thing, that was a long time ago. And secondly, that's not a compliment. If you know anything about Murray Gell-Mann, you know that Murray Gell-Mann never gave and gives compliments. It sounds like it might be. Yeah, no. The implied thing is the O as and the question mark, as in if he's somebody who's not known to Murray, he's not really worth talking about. And so you get the tone. Well, I mean, my agent used it to good.
Yeah,
but that's my agent. So. Well, do you have a book? Oh, so if you have a book, you can get an agent. And okay, so let me just understand what you all know and what you don't know. So I understand that Sundance spoke to you last night and gave some basic ideas about general relativity. Have you done anything else with general relativity? No, I know. We had a little confer. Richard did a little bit of general relativity. Okay. Okay, and you've done a little bit of quantum mechanics. Some of you have done a lot of quantum mechanics. So the basic situation, let's just start from the basics, is that the 20th century was a period of revolution in physics. The 20th century began with most professional physicists of the view that physics was understood and was understood by a combination of Newtonian mechanics and electrodynamics. And they had weird ideas about unifying them at the time, going back exactly to the beginning of the 20th century, about 1900. One of them was that the world was filled with a material, the ether, which was extremely dense so that sound waves in it, and very strange so that sound waves in it were transverse rather than longitudinal, like real sound waves. And traveled at the speed of light, and that was what light was supposed to be. And electromagnetism was supposed to be the study of stresses and strains in the ether. And particles were supposed to be vortices in the ether. And there was an idea that there were different ways that the vortices could be tied up. For example, they could be linked. Or they could be, and I always get in trouble drawing this. Sundance is much better at this than I am. They could be knotted. Did I do that right? I think so. Yeah?
But the trefoil on the right isn't closed on the top right corner.
Oh, this isn't a trefoil. This is
the right.
No, the, on the right.
Yeah.
On the top right corner. Oh, it's actually closed up. Yeah.
Okay. People had the idea that the different kinds of atomic elements might be different kinds of knots or links in the vector fields of the stresses in the ether, And because of that, in the 1880s, I think, in 1890s, some mathematicians began classifying the ways to the different types of knots. And thus was begun the mathematical study of knots in order to classify the different kinds of atoms. And that's an interesting lesson because that turned out to be the wrong theory of atoms and the wrong theory of electromagnetism and the wrong theory of the nature of space. But nonetheless, the mathematical study of knots has proved to be a very deep and challenging part of mathematics, part of the subject of topology. So this wrong science gave rise to some very beautiful mathematics. And indeed, the subject of topology is, I'm just going to make from time to time some asides about pedagogy and so forth. The subject of topology is not usually taught except to math majors in university. But the subject of topology, like aspects of number theory, are aspects of mathematics which are accessible to junior high school students who are interested, and certainly could be taught. Even simple questions like, can you give a rule or a game such that if I draw you a complicated knot on the blackboard, you can tell if it can be, now, I'm not really doing it right because I would have to put all the over and under crossings. But supposing I put all the over and under crossings, the question you could ask is there a simple rule by which you could tell whether that was really just not knotted, just a piece of string? And that's a problem that took, if I have my facts right, into the 1980s to give a solution to, if it's just one piece of string. And if there are two pieces of string, so it might be that it untangles to two pieces of string like that, my impression is that the problem is unsolved. Okay, so there are very elementary questions you can ask about knots and related structures, simple topological games in three dimensions, which are very profound and challenging, and nonetheless are fun to play with. And even useful if you sail or windsurf or something like that. What happened? What happened to that whole part of science was two things. One of them was special relativity, which got restored the notion of the relativity of inertial frames and the impossibility of there being a state of at rest, and in a way that was consistent with electromagnetism. Then general relativity, which is the theory, Einstein's theory of gravitation, in which space and time become dynamical and curved. And I'll come back and say a bit more about general relativity. And then, of course, quantum mechanics was necessary to have a correct theory of the atom. And this stuff just faded away into mathematics until recently. So part of my story is how those kinds of mathematical structures came back into physics. Now, general relativity was in final form by end of 1915, 1916. And it has, in the domain in which it can be tested, which is the solar system, which is tests of light bending on scales ranging from bent by the stars, starlight bent by the sun, to images of galaxies bent by the dark matter, we believe, of other galaxies. It's turned out enormously well. General relativity. I will make a little editorial comment since I'm told you spent several hours on dark matter. I hope whoever discussed dark matter with you mentioned that there's a dark side to dark matter. That is, there's another point of view, and just for fairness, and again, this is something that can be easily explained to high school students, one possible reading of dark matter, of the dark matter conundrum, is that general relativity is wrong, and another theory of gravity becomes relevant on scales of galaxies. And one way to read dark energy problem is that general relativity is wrong, and another theory, yet another theory, becomes relevant on cosmological scales. The dark matter hypothesis is, for some problems, in better shape than the hypothesis of an alternative theory of gravity. But the hypothesis of an alternative theory of gravity on scales of galaxies is called MONGE, for modified Newtonian dynamics. And it does rather well. And if you haven't heard that story, that's a story that I'm not going to go into today, but is worth going into at some point. And on scales of cosmological scales, we're completely perplexed. So modulo the identification of dark matter and dark energy, general relativity appears to be a highly successful theory, but it has no relation to quantum mechanics. And similarly, quantum mechanics, through the experimental tests of the Standard Model, which are very precise, and the experimental tests of quantum electrodynamics, and many, many other things, many, many other high-precision tests, quantum mechanics is a very well-verified theory. The problem is that there are two different theories, each of which is a kind of overreaching what Einstein called the theory of principle. And I think that this is an important thing to introduce. So I'll write the notion down. This was Einstein's idea. And his idea is that there are some theories which are just about particular things in the world, like hydrodynamics is just about liquids, and its solid state physics is just about matter in the solid state. Atomic physics is just about atoms. Electromagnetism is just about the electromagnetic interaction. And these kinds of theories can sit alongside a lot of other different possibilities. There could be many different types of elementary particles consistent with the idea of electromagnetism, as far as we know. Then there are other theories. So then there are other theories which provide the language and the framework for talking about nature. And these are theories of principle. Okay, Newtonian physics is a theory of principle. Newtonian physics says there is matter. Matter obeys Newton's first law, that particles with no forces on them, or matter with no forces on them, or bodies, travel at a constant speed and direction. Newtonian physics says that interactions in the world are described in terms of forces, and you have the second law and the third law to analyze the influence of forces. So it's a framework for thinking about all phenomenon, and it stands or falls, and indeed fell, on its ability to encompass all phenomena in nature. Okay, so that's what Einstein meant by a theory of principle, something which is a framework and a language for all nature, for all of nature, for everything. Now, once you have a theory of principle, you could have a lot of different kinds of forces, a lot of different kinds of matter, maybe, okay, at least in principle. But you can only have one theory of principle. We can only have one theory that gives the framework and the language for describing everything in nature. And the problem is that quantum mechanics is a theory of principle, and so is general relativity. I hope it's okay if I use abbreviations. Just my handwriting would not be much more communicative. So the problem is that as of about 1927, we had two theories of principle. Okay, and that's a problem. Now, and that's the problem of quantum gravity, is to replace them, to replace or unify these into a single theory of principle. That's the problem. Now, the problem is not solved, although there have been a lot of interesting ideas, a lot of proposals. Several proposals, two in particular, have been developed technically quite a long way. And that's string theory and loop quantum gravity. But still, we don't regard the problem as solved. And one reason we don't regard the problem as solved is that this is science. And science requires the theories not just be proposed and studied and talked about and published about and have conferences about them, etc., but that they must make predictions, and those predictions, in the view of most of us, must be what's called falsifiable. And this is a concept of a philosopher called Karl Popper, and what it means is that you must be able to pose an experimental test for a doable experiment and propose the precise result of the experiment such that if the experiment turns out differently, the logic goes back and says the theory is wrong. Okay, so you must be able to make a crucial test of the theory that if you get a prediction other than that predicted, then it means that the theory is wrong. And Popper argued, and there's been a lot of subtleties discussed by philosophers since then, but roughly speaking, the idea is that science progresses not only because theories are proposed and verified, but more importantly, because the theories which are verified by experiment that we learn about and we tend to believe and teach to our students are always vulnerable to further falsification. So everything we teach has a vulnerability about it, a temporality about it, because there are always future experiments that could falsify it. And Popper argued that that's an important feature of science that distinguishes it from other activities. And that, of course, can lead to lots of discussion, which we can have later. But the important question, one of the reasons why the problem is not solved, is that there has not been performed an experiment that could falsify any of the theories that have been proposed. Now, what are the phenomena that could be relevant for a quantum theory of gravity? Because if we're talking about experiment, we're talking about phenomena, and you know, such an important thing, I mean, this is really the framework, the foundations of our thinking about nature. Such an important thing must be relevant for a description of some phenomenon. So why have we survived on the order of 80 years, no, in fact, 80 years in science with a lot of development going ahead without this problem being solved? And the answer can be understood really just from dimensional analysis. Okay. So let me do some basic dimensional analysis, which is relevant to the question. So from quantum mechanics, there's a constant, Planck's constant, which is h bar. In general relativity, there are two fundamental constants, which are Newton's constant and the speed of light. And there's a remarkable feature of those three fundamental constants. And this remarkable feature was actually noticed for the first time by Planck at the very same time that he introduced what we now call Planck's constant. And he did it in a slightly different form, but we don't, that's not a concern of us. Planck understood the following important thing, which is that with these three constants, you can make units for all the common physical quantities, length, time, mass, energy, force, momentum, whatever you like. Okay. And so let me give you an example. If you take h bar times Newton's constant over the speed of light, I believe cubed. Occasionally I get that wrong. Okay. And you work out the what?
Yeah. Hmm? Meter and square.
Yes, you know this. Yes, if you work this out, this is length squared. And so if I take the square root of that, that's a length, and that's called the Planck length. And it's about 1.6 times 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Okay. And that is about 20 orders of magnitude smaller than the size of an atomic nuclei, which is a Fermi. Okay, so that's part of the problem. About 10 to the minus 20 of a nuclei. So the general relativity is a theory of space and time. And it tells us about the geometry of space. But any quantum theory of gravity tells us that the geometry of space is going to be very different than has been described before it, but only probing down to this scale. So it's very difficult to do experiments that probe down to that scale, although, as I will tell you shortly, it's not impossible and it's being done. So actually, there's some good news in what I'm going to say. But it's very difficult. Similarly, there's so this is usually called LPL for the Planck length. There's a Planck time, which is the Planck length over the speed of light, and that's about 10 to the minus 43 of a second. And again, that's about 10 to the minus 20th. It's one part 10 to the 20th of the frequencies involved in nuclear physics. And there's a Planck mass, which is h bar over the Planck length. And there's, I think, times the speed of light. This h bar is energy seconds, right? So it's over the Planck time. And that's an energy. So it's m Planck c squared. I think that's correct. And in energy units, that's 10 to the 19 GeV, or about, in units that are relevant for news stories these days, it's about 10 to the 16 TeVs, which is the scale of the Large Hadron Collider that's turning on in Geneva. Okay. In mass units, it's also interesting if you take off the C squared. In mass units, that's about 10 to the minus fifth of a gram, or about the scale of a bacteria. So that's the problem. That's the problem, and that's the reason why physics has gone on progressing in many areas. You know, in the Standard Model was developed, a lot of condensed matter physics is developed, a lot of enormous amount of astronomy and cosmology has been developed, all without solving this problem, because the phenomena that it's relevant to takes place at energies which are so tiny in distance, so short in time, compared to the scales that we can observe with ordinary experiments, The energies, if you try to create these energies in a collision, thinking like an elementary particle physicist, you're 15 or 16 orders of magnitude off the best that can be done now. And an important thing to know is that the relationship in particle physics between energy and money is logarithmic. Okay? So that 16 orders of magnitude is not going to come soon. Okay. Any questions at this point? So roughly speaking, us now, it almost seems like us speculating about physics at these tiny, tiny energies is not that different from the ancient Greeks or the Arabic scientists or the medieval scientists speculating about the existence of the atom. This is just way off of standard experimental physics. Okay, so that's the bad news. Okay, now, therefore, the LHC, as important as the LHC is very unlikely to produce any result that's relevant for quantum gravity. There is a little out. There's a little out. And the little out should be mentioned because it's going to be mentioned in the newspapers when the LHC turns on. The little out is that there are higher dimensional theories of the standard model in which there are two or more extra dimensions in the universe, okay, in which a little trick is played in such a way that this scale, actually the way to put it is to this scale becomes expanded hugely. Even though Newton's constant as we observe it doesn't change, Newton's constant in the higher dimensional world is much, much bigger. And the result is that there could be quantum gravity effects in this higher dimensional world at a much larger distance scale and a much lower energy scale. Okay. And that's a long, 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 long shot. Okay. But nonetheless, that's why people worry about creating quantum black holes at the LHC. Okay. And by the way, so it's a long, long, long shot. It's unlikely to happen. There are basic questions about those higher dimensional theories, like what keeps them stable, what keeps the extra dimensions from collapsing from the force of gravity, things like that that are, to me anyway, murky. So I don't think it's a likely possibility. But nonetheless, it should be mentioned. Otherwise, accelerator type of experiments are not going to get us there. Okay. So at this point, people make statements like, well, we can't do quantum gravity experimentally. We would need an accelerator the size of the galaxy, an LHC the size of the galaxy, et cetera. So what are we going to do? How does science progress? And actually, it turns out that there is at least one window. And I wonder if anybody sees it, who didn't already know. There is one window into which is being explored into this world. Yes, well, it involves the universe, yes.
On a large scale rather than some man-made.
Yes, yes. Yes. Can you say more?
Black holes?
No. I mean, black holes, yes. What, if we had, let me say black holes. Ask me about black holes later. Okay.
Gamma ray bursts?
Yeah. How do we use gamma ray bursts?
No idea.
Well, the glass has just been launched.
Mark Perry and 501.
Mark Perry and 501 is relevant?
Looking at a change in velocity for the different frequencies.
Mm-hmm. A change in velocity of what?
Of the radiation.
Light, yeah. So you all know this.
No.
Okay. So let's keep doing some dimensional analysis. Okay. So I assume that you know the basics of special relativity, basic special relativity? Okay. So this is an interesting story sociologically, because this is a story about young people who get new ideas which turn out to be the right ideas that older people miss. And in this particular case, there were several in the late 90s. Perhaps the most influential was somebody called Giovanni Amelino Camelia, who is an Italian from Napoli, now working in Rome. And he reasoned with some colleagues as follows. So what he basically did is said, look, this Planck length is the scale of quantum gravity phenomenon. When it's zero, quantum gravity is turned off, because it's h bar times g. So when it's zero, quantum gravity is turned off. And either h bar is zero or g is zero, okay, or both. Okay. So what he said is, let's take all the basic equations of physics and just add terms that look like order L Planck in front of them. So for example, you could take the speed of light is c, is universal in special relativity, times 1 plus terms of order L Planck. Okay. And what do we need then if we're going to make something? One is dimensionless, so we have to make something which is dimensionless. Okay, so we can have a frequency, and then we have a length over time, and we have to put it over the speed of light. Okay, and we can put a constant there. Thank you. Alpha. Thank you very much. Okay, so that's, and his point was, we don't know, there are different proposals. There's loop quantum gravity, string theory, causal sets, brains, quantum gravity, a long list of different proposals, dynamical triangulation for the quantum theory of gravity. But when it comes down to experiment, this is the kind of thing that they could produce. Okay. And we'll worry, a different theory might give you a prediction for alpha. It might give you a prediction that alpha was zero. Okay. Maybe you would have to, maybe alpha is zero, and you have to go to the next order, say beta L Planck squared omega squared over c squared. Okay, but you should start to see an effect. Now, before I go on, there is a reason why alpha and beta, you might think that alpha and beta are zero. Can anybody know what that?
Because the speed of light is supposed to always be c?
Yeah. So you might worry about special relativity. Okay. And if I have time, I'll come back to that in a little while. Okay. For now, let's just think like experimentalists, and let's not worry about theory. You might think, I mean, if, you know, it's plausible that this violates the principles of special relativity, like the principle that the speed of light is a universal constant. It seems to. Okay. But of course, I mean, you might also say it doesn't, because there is the speed of light, which is a universal constant. There is C, which is a universal constant. It just says that the speed of a particular photon of some frequency is slightly different from that. Okay. Now, now that's the first step. And then the question is, how hard is it to see that? Okay. Well, so now I'm going to embarrass by myself by doing some elementary, really elementary stuff, which I'll probably screw up. But, you know, supposing that, let me find enough space that I can screw up. So, you know, supposing that the Earth is here, and we're looking out, and here's some astrophysical phenomenon, a star or something, is a distance L, the light is traveling. And suppose that you start off here with a burst of light. So you get some burst of light of different frequencies, and there's a spread of frequencies delta omega there. Okay. So what's the difference in arrival time? Let me say delta T is the difference in arrival time when you get there. Okay, so the arrival time is, this is where I'm going to screw up, the distance over the speed, right? Okay, which is the distance over C times 1 minus, because it's over, L Planck omega over C. So the change in arrival time is, the sign doesn't matter, but it happens to be minus alpha L Planck, the change of omega over C squared. And is that, that looks right. Is that right? Hmm? Okay. Okay, so interestingly enough, if you work that out, and I'm not going to embarrass myself and do it in front of you, if delta omega is on the order of gamma rays, which I don't remember what the frequency is, but somebody here probably knows, and you work that out, then delta t is about a millisecond. If, sorry, I forgot to tell you what L is. So L is, so let's say that L is the scale of the universe, the cosmological scale, which is something like 10 to the 27 centimeters. Is that right? Or is it 10 to the 17 or 10 to the 27? Okay, so the speed of light is 10 to the 7 seconds in a year. Okay, so we have 10 to the 10 years times 10 to the 7 seconds in a year times the speed of light is 10 to the 10 centimeters per second. So it's 10 to the 27. Okay, so this is on the order of the cosmological scale. Okay, and please check that, and if I screwed that up, let me know. Okay, so that's a prediction. That's a prediction. And there are gamma ray bursts, which are, we're not sure what they are, but they may be neutron stars spiraling down into each other. They let off a big burst of radiation. And in the gamma wave frequencies, they're at cosmological distance scale, and then they happen about once a day. They're received somewhere They were discovered accidentally by satellites that were designed to look for nuclear testing. Okay. And a millisecond, of course, is a long time for modern electronics. Okay. So if you see several hundred of these, and there's a systematic delta omega that is on the average, if you look at the very blue light and the very red light, and the very blue light has a burst that looks like this, and the very red light has a burst that looks like this. And if averaged over hundreds of these, that's about that exists, and that's a thousandth of a second. That's an effect that could be seen. And so that's what the GLAST, it's not what the GLAST satellite was designed to do, but it's part of the mission now of the GLAST satellite. Yes?
Dispersion due to other causes.
That's a very important question. You and it's been done. You study all the other possible causes, and they are not, they don't produce something of this scale. And there's, of course, there's been papers which have studied that. If you look at, somebody mentioned Markovian 501, which are TeV scale bursts, of which there's a number which are seen. I don't remember the length, they're closer. They're coming from active galactic nuclei, so they're somewhat closer. An example is Markovian 501. But there, if you work it out, and I apologize, I don't remember the length, so you'll have to work it out backwards. You get a time scale on the order of minutes. Okay. So what you're doing is you're taking a tiny, tiny, tiny effect. Okay, this has 1 over c squared in it. It has the square root of h bar in it, square root of Newton's constant in it. It has a tiny, tiny, tiny effect. And you're letting it amplify over huge distances, because the effect is proportional to the distance traveled. And so you're using, if you want to make a slogan about this, you're using the universe as a whole as an amplifier. Okay, to take a tiny, tiny effect, which is down at these scales, 20 orders of magnitude smaller than an atom, than an atomic nuclei, and spread it out just by waiting for billions of years as the light travels for the frequencies to sort themselves out. Okay. Now, there is an experiment. I say this with a lot of due caution. There's an experiment called MAGIC, which is a detector of these guys, and they claim a detection. Okay. So they claim that they see a delta T, which is 4 minutes, which is on the scale which is predicted by this kind of term here. They're seeing TeV scale light. They're detecting it. It's an Earthbound experiment. I don't really know the astronomy. I think it's an active galactic nuclei. So it's some huge. It's believed to be some shock wave powered by the inflow into a rotating black hole, okay, producing a massive jet of radiation material which generates a shock wave, which probably shocks some, I'm making this up as I go along, some electrons or positrons, which produces some photons. Okay, but it produces a burst of photons in the TeV, so the same energy scale as the LHC. And
showers or something?
They focus on these sources. These are sources. They're intermittent sources. They're going to do something like that. They focus on these sources, And then they observe in several different frequency bands, and they draw a picture like this. Now, a lot of skepticism should be and has been, and they don't, you know, they don't report a discovery, they report a detection, which is different. For a detection to become a discovery, at least two things would have to happen. One, that other explanations could be ruled out, and that's and in this case, you're talking about, you know, one of these active galactic nuclei, which is much bigger than 4 light minutes across. So it's a huge thing, powering with a lot of energy pouring out of it, again, presumably powered by the inflow into a black hole at the center of the galaxy. And it's very plausible that there's some mundane astrophysical reason for why the red light leaves a little bit earlier than the blue light. And I think it's that order. I'm not sure. I think the red comes before the blue, if I remember right. And the other thing is that there are other such TEV bursts which are known, and they've been observed and studied by the same detector and other detectors. Another one is called Veritas, I think. And the effect would have to be seen in every source because it's supposed to be a universal effect. It's supposed to be an effect due to the quantum nature of space and time. Okay, so it has to be observed in every source, and other explanations have to be ruled out. And neither of those things have happened. So there's one observation. But what it shows is that there can be quantum gravity experiments. Okay. So, any questions? There already has been, however, a related experiment. And this is a little bit more subtle, but I think it's worth mentioning. And this has to do with cosmic rays. And by the way, is this okay? Is this the right, you know, is the right level, speed? Okay. So let's look a little bit. I don't know why this is. I hit it and it's making us there. Let's look a little bit into special relativity and where this might have come from. Okay. So in special relativity, there's a relationship between energy and momentum for photons, okay, which is that E squared is P squared times C squared. Do people know this? Okay. And if there happens to be a particle with mass, so I'll just add this, there's plus m squared c to the fourth. And you can get the speed if you have, this is a relationship between energy and momentum. If you have a relationship between energy and momentum, you can get the speed of any particle, if you know the relationship between energy and momentum, as the derivative of dE by dP, of d energy by d momentum. Okay. And if you work the, and so if you don't have a mass, you just get c. If you want to get terms like this, then you have to add terms to the relationship between energy and momentum. And the term which gives you this term in the frequency, using, of course, that the energy is related to h bar times the frequency, would be a term that goes like L Planck, the energy cubed, alpha goes there, and there's some factor of h bar, which I don't remember. L Planck, it just is over H Planck. Okay, so if you want to have a relationship between energy and momentum, which gives you a speed when there's no mass, which is the formula we've been studying, you just add a term proportional to L Planck, and dimensionally you need an energy cubed together with an H bar to make something which is an energy squared. Okay. And if you want to get the next term is beta L Planck squared e to the fourth over H bar squared. Okay. So these are, again, things that you would expect coming from any quantum theory of gravity. Okay. And they seem to violate these basic formulas from special relativity. But who says that special relativity is sacred? Okay. I will come back to special relativity in a few minutes. I want to talk about one more experiment. Okay. Well, does anybody know what is the most energetic test of special relativity that's ever been done? Okay, so that is a quick question because it's a lead and it's the experiment I'm going to tell you about. And it's an experiment that was reported on only in November. And it's also an astronomical experiment. And it has to do with cosmic rays. And so let me tell you, and it was anticipated, this particular experiment was anticipated in the early 1960s. And let me tell you the basic idea. Okay. So if you look at the spectrum of cosmic rays, if you look at the energy and the number of cosmic rays of that energy, and I guess you look at the logs. I'm not used to doing things so that everything becomes a straight line, or at least polynomials become a straight line. Then the cosmic ray spectrum looks like a straight line, and the number falls like 1 over the energy cubed, roughly cubed, over many, many orders of magnitude, over something more than 10 orders of magnitude. And this is something that was observed already by the 1960s. The sources of cosmic rays have always been a mystery, by the way. And in the 1960s, there were three Soviet physicists whose names I don't remember, but their initials are G, Z, and K. So this is called the GZK phenomenon. And they observed the following, that there would be an energy such that the cosmic rays would have so much energy that they would interact with the cosmic microwave background. And so what does this mean? That this means that a proton with a certain amount of energy, let's call it energy GZK, would be able to scatter off of a photon in the microwave background, which we know is there. And by the way, these papers were written shortly after the cosmic microwave background was discovered, which was 63, 64, something like that. Okay. And they would, there are several things that could happen, but let's concentrate on one of them, is that they would produce a pi zero. Okay. And the proton, so this is a proton, the proton would keep going, but it would have less energy because it would produce a pi meson. Okay. And so what that would mean is that if you had a cosmic ray somewhere way out here, remember this thing is falling, but somewhere way out here, it would lose energy by passing through the cosmic microwave background. And until its energy was below this energy, GZK, which was the threshold for this to happen. If it has less energy, it doesn't. So this threshold is somewhere here, EGZK. EGZK is about 3 times 10 to the 19 electron volts, okay, which means it's a billionth of the Planck energy. Of the Planck energy, of the M Planck's, this is the Planck energy. It's 1 billionth of that. Did I say? Yes.
Good
work,
job.
I'm not right.
It was 2 different papers. G and Z were 1 paper, and K was another paper.
Right at the bottom on the left.
That's it.
Fix it, of course.
And this was something like 1964. Okay. And I don't know if any of these 3 gentlemen are still alive, but because this is the story of the test of their prediction, which finally became possible basically this year. Okay. So the prediction is that this curve would go up a little bit and would come down. Okay. But let me be a little bit more precise. It would come down over the threshold, okay, because it turns out that there's a mean free path. There's a mean free path that it takes some space for this to happen, and the mean free path is not small, it's about 75 megaparsecs. Okay? And there's a lot of galaxies within 75 megaparsecs. There's not tons and tons, but there's some dozens of galaxies, dozens to hundreds of galaxies within 75 megaparsecs. Okay. So, this was the prediction, right? And what we're talking about is testing. So it turns out that this, if you work out the formulas for the energy that you need to produce the pion, so this is a basic calculation in energy and momentum conservation in special relativity, okay? And it only involves special relativity. So it only tests special relativity. Plus energy conservation, plus momentum conservation. So again, it's something that you can easily work out. You could easily work out with a class of students. And you're testing special relativity at this energy. Another way to say it is that the gamma factor, the 1/√(1 − v²/c²) involved, which is the energy over the mass of the proton, is about 10 to the 11th. Okay? So that's the highest gamma factor that special relativity has ever been tested at. Yes?
Planck energy, some kind of magic limit or something?
Well, it's not in here. This happens to be a billionth of
it. Coming over there, is that like the largest something could be? Why, is there any meaning to it?
Well, it's meaning to it. It might be in a different theory, but I've been trying to do this in a very theory-independent way. Okay, it's a scale at which you expect to see effects where both h bar is relevant, g is relevant, and c is relevant. And that's all that an experimenter needs to know. So, um, So what does this have to do with special relativity? Well, it was noticed much after the 1960s, I think in the 1980s and 1990s, I think probably in the 1990s, that even though the Planck mass is a billion times this energy, if you put a term here, if you put this term here with alpha of order 1, okay, then you move the threshold of order 1. And the reason is, and I'm not going to do the arithmetic for you, the reason is that there's a ratio of the energy of that proton over the Planck energy, which is about a billion. A billion. But there's another ratio of about a billion, which is the energy of the photon in the cosmic microwave over the mass of the pi meson. And because of that coincidence, if you do, again, it's just basic algebra, you find that this prediction is affected of order 1. If alpha, in fact, or beta are numbers of the order of 1. Okay, so that's too complicated for me to do without screwing up in front of you. But it is something that it is just basic algebra. And it has to do with the fact that at the threshold, at the energy where the pion can just be produced, you have zeros happening. That's what it means, a threshold. Both sides of an equation are becoming zero. So small things can move things around. Small ratios can move things around if you have a coincidence like this. So this turns out to be a good test of not just special relativity, but of terms like this and this that could be measuring deviations from special relativity. Okay. So with the computer, I could show you a few slides with a little bit of data. But I think if we take time to do that, then I can't tell you something else I want to tell you. So let me just tell you the story of the data. The story of the data is that there was a Japanese experiment in the 1990s which saw about a dozen events out here where they're not supposed to be. And the name of that experiment is, will come to me in a minute. Okay. So there was some drama in the field. That is, if you took this Japanese, so this was a big cosmic ray detector. It was the biggest one thus far as of that time. And if you took their data literally, then this prediction was contradicted. That is, they saw about a dozen cosmic rays with energy over this event. And let me emphasize, this is a lot of energy. This is the energy in a pitch in baseball. This is the energy in a good hard serve in professional tennis. Okay, this is a lot of energy for one proton to be carrying. Okay. Then there were some American and European experiments. One was called Hi-Res, which didn't see the extra events out here. Okay, so then there was controversy. And partly because of this, and partly for many other reasons, over the last 10 years or so, a detector has been constructed in Argentina called Auger, for Pierre Auger, who I think was the discoverer of cosmic rays. This is an amazing thing. This is spread over a region of the Argentinian Pampas, something like 100 kilometers by 100 kilometers. And within that, I think every kilometer or fraction of a kilometer on a square grid, there's a cosmic ray detector. There are also some cameras that measure the cosmic rays when they streak through the atmosphere, put out ultraviolet light. They make the atmosphere phosphoresce and put out ultraviolet light. And there are also a network of cameras looking up, and they measure both the energy as you can get from the photograph of the light in the cameras, and the energy from the detectors on the ground, which are excited, and they have good resolution. And they had a paper which was in November of last year. It was in Science, and I believe it was the cover story. And later I could get or send the precise reference. Let me just show what they found. So what they discovered is very exciting. What they discovered is that they have events over the threshold. And remember, it's a 1 over energy cube. So as you get out here, you're getting fewer and fewer. But they have about, in the data set that they published, they had 27 events greater than the threshold energy. And they had, because of the two kinds of detectors, they have about 2-degree resolution of position in the sky. Okay. Not only that, okay, at a lower energy, you can't tell where the cosmic rays are coming from because they're charged particles and the galaxy has a big magnetic field when integrated over the size of the galaxy. And cosmic rays spiral around chaotically in the galaxy, so you can't tell where they're coming from. But out here, within a degree or so, they point back. They're good indicators. So they looked on the sky, and they drew circles of 2 degrees around each of these things. And then they got a catalog of active galactic nuclei, which are these galaxies with big black holes in the center pouring out a lot of energy. And what they found was that these positions correlated well with active galactic nuclei in the sky, okay, but only within 75 megaparsecs. Okay. And the correlation is something like, I'm making this up, but something like greater than 95% probability for a correlation. Okay. Yes.
In the sky, is there likely to be active galactic nuclei?
No. Excuse me. Yes, but not within 75 megaparsecs. Mm-hmm.
So this is statistically quite significant.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And these people do their homework. Yeah. I mean, they worked very hard. And what was interesting about this is that they didn't say they were going to do this experiment this way. So what everybody was waiting for was to see whether this curve came down. Okay. And the idea of looking for correlations with sources was to my, I'm not in the field, but certainly, but I've been following the field because it's relevant for the theoretical work that I do. And I never heard anybody say, we're going to try to go at this by correlating to sources in the sky. And in fact, I was in Brazil in October at a conference, and there's also a Brazilian philosopher that I'm working with there. And I happened for 2 days in Rio to have an office in the Physics Institute there next door to somebody in the experiment. Right. And at the conference where we were both at, he gave a talk, and what he said in the talk is, okay, the distribution is isotropic in the sky that we're seeing. That is, it's random in the sky. Okay. But we have something else, but that I'm not going to say. Okay. And in the 2 days, well, actually, I traveled with him to Rio, and on the flight, he leaked. He swore me to secrecy, and leaked this, okay, and in Rio gave me the draft of the paper, swearing me to secrecy, So I knew enough that we had in November here a workshop on these kind of experiments. We call the subject quantum gravity phenomenology. And I got the organizer of the workshop, Sabina Hassenfelder, to invite somebody from the collaboration, okay, with a talk that was timed for the release date. Because when you publish with Science, there's an embargo. You're not allowed to publish a preprint. You're not allowed to put out a press release. You're not allowed to mention the result in a talk. It has to appear first on the publication date of Science. Nature is apparently the same way. So we got a talk from a member of the collaboration scheduled for the release day. So we had the first first talk with these results. And I think it's on Pearsys. It can be found. And we could look that up. And maybe that would be better than me trying to fake the rest of the details. And we also had a colloquium later by a Brazilian physicist astronomer who's head of the astronomy department at Chicago, whose name I'll also. So you could also look up that talk. But what this does, this is highly cool. So what this does is it confirms the prediction made by these three gentlemen in the early 60s. The fact that there's, and the correlation is only within, and they have a chart which shows that if you try to correlate further with galaxies further out, the correlation falls apart. And it falls apart before you lose the statistics because you cover the whole sky with the 2-degree circles. So it is a confirmation of the prediction of G, Z, and K. It does, therefore, confirm special relativity. So it therefore suggests that this term should not be here. It is a test of this term. And I'm going to use the rest of the time to talk about what it really confirms about special relativity. And it does one more thing, which is very, very cool. Two more things. One of them is it points back to sources. This is the very first time that sources of cosmic rays have been identified in the sky. Now, it's not a new idea that the high-energy cosmic rays may come from active galactic nuclei. That's not a new idea, but it's a confirmation of that idea. Of course, if you're conservative, all you can say is that there's a correlation between the sources of the high-energy cosmic rays and the active galactic nuclei. It's not a proof that they're the same thing. Okay? But it's for the first time that there's any evidence about the sources of cosmic rays, which is a long-standing mystery in science, is where do these things come from? Okay? And it's also the first time astronomy has been done with charged particles. It's the first time that a proton or electron has been used to observe a source in astronomy. So it's a very cool experiment. And it checks special relativity at a higher energy and a larger gamma than has ever been done before. So it's all around a very cool experiment. OK, questions? Oh, sure. That's why it was a science article. Yeah. I mean, said, and it's an interesting lesson, said very modestly, said very cautiously. You know, there's an art to the way that when scientists, you know, when observers or experimentalists have something really good, they phrase it very carefully and modestly. Just in case, because it might be that the source is not the active galactic nuclei. It's some, you know, it's something which is nearby, but happens in the sky to be associated with the active galactic nuclei. They want to be cautious. Okay, so I have something like 15 more minutes. Is that right? Okay. So I'm not going to get back to the knots, which I apologize for, but because this is going a clear. There's only one thing I can do for the last 15 minutes. Which is address the question, at least raise the question and offer a suggestion as to whether this really means that special relativity is confirmed at when quantum gravity is relevant. Okay, so I need fresh blackboard. And unfortunately, no, I'm okay. No, I'm just going to use this one and then the one under it. I don't know, how many of you have taught special relativity? Okay, me also. Here's a question. Here's a question that I've never had, and you can tell me if any student has ever asked this question. Okay, so we write down the principles of special relativity, right? The principles of special relativity. Okay. One, okay, the relativity of inertial frames. Okay. Two, the speed of light. Well, I'll write it. Let me just write c, by which we mean the speed of light, okay, is a universal constant. Doesn't transform. Okay. And then from those, we derive the Lorentz transformations. Okay. Did you ever have a student who said, why couldn't there be a third principle? Something else is also a universal constant. Did you ever get that question? Why is there only one universal constant? Okay. So I don't know what's wrong with all of our students. Okay. Cuz
yeah.
Well, but I mean that's true of a large proportion of them, but there are those interested in knowledge. Okay. I've taught special relativity many times. I expect some of you have. Okay. It's an it's just interesting, these obvious questions that nobody asks. Well, yeah, so there is G and H and so forth. But I don't mean G and H. I mean something that you think would transform from observer to. Okay, so this says that the first principle says that you have to, that a moving, an observer moving with a constant speed with respect to observer. Right, so could there be something like a unit of distance or time or energy, which is also universal, which doesn't transform? That's what I mean. The way we get into trouble here is we're used to thinking that velocities transform when we go between observers who are moving relative to each other, and then we say, no, the speed of there's one speed that doesn't transform. That implies that energies transform, momenta transform, lengths transform, times transform. Okay. So the question is, could there be one length or one distance or one mass or something like that, one energy that doesn't transform? That's the meaning of the question. Okay. So it would take a thoughtful student to ask the question. Okay. And I never had a student who asked the question, and I never asked the question myself. Okay. Actually, I did ask the question once myself. But I didn't. I decided it was a silly question, you know, which is it's embarrassing when you remember these things. I asked the question because I was working on a theory of quantum gravity, loop quantum gravity, and it said that there's some network of knots, okay, and the scale here is one Planck length. That is, if you look down at a Planck length, you're going to see some. Space is not going to be smooth. It's going to be sort of something woven out of knots. Okay? And we were worrying about what happens if you're an observer and you make a Lorentz transformation to a moving observer and you look at this quantum geometry made up of a network of knots. Okay? Is the Planck length, which is the spacing of these knots, going to be Lorentz transformed? Okay. So so a question is, if you're thinking about quantum gravity, could L Planck be also a universal constant? Yes?
Photon with a constant speed, or yeah, constant speed. So wouldn't it also have a fixed unit of energy?
Right. So it could be an energy, a length, a frequency, an energy. Okay. Could these constants be universal?
C, G, and the H.
Right, but which of course is constant. But so my meaning is, here's my meaning. Okay, supposing I have a quantum theory of gravity, okay, and it predicts that when you look smaller than some length, you're going to see geometry to be quantum mechanical. You're going to see new phenomena, whatever that means in your theory. Okay. So I see that there's some length that if I have a wavelength of light that I'm using to look smaller and smaller, and I use a wavelength smaller than that, I'm going to see some new phenomenon. Okay? And now I worry about whether that makes sense with special relativity, because an observer moving by will see a threshold at their Planck length, which is however I'm going to see as length contracted relative to mine. So am I going to get into a paradox between quantum gravity asking for new phenomena at that scale and special relativity? Okay. And a solution to that paradox, and you can make that into a real paradox if you try hard, okay, is to add a third principle here.
Of a fixed value, constant, or would Planck's length actually change and stretch due to gravity and yo-yo back and forth cyclic universe? Like, would that value actually change?
Let me assume not. But what I'm worrying about now is, do they Lorentz transform? Do these constants Lorentz transform? Okay. So that's a question. And the interesting thing is that you can do this. And what you have to do when you do this, okay, is that a fourth principle, but only one more, okay, which is that C is the speed of a photon. So C is universal, but C is the speed of a photon in the limit as there are various ways to say this, but let's say the Planck length, the ratio of the Planck length over its wavelength goes to zero. So for photons like the ones we observe in the laboratories, whose wavelengths are large compared to this tiny length of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, C is going to be approximately the speed of those photons and will be universal. Okay? But when you have photons whose wavelength is getting short compared to the Planck length, okay, C is not going to be their speed. Okay. And therefore, that formula at the top could make sense, because that agrees with that formula at the top. The correction to C is proportional to L Planck L Planck times the frequency over the speed of light is L Planck over the wavelength of light. Okay? So this allows you to have corrections to the speed of light. Okay? So this is an extension of the principles of special relativity, which allows there to be not just one velocity that doesn't transform, but you get a length that doesn't transform. You get a time that doesn't transform. You get an energy that doesn't transform. Okay? And this whole thing is called doubly special relativity. Or sometimes it's called deformed special relativity, but it's called DSR. It's because it's the, you know, it's the question that was not asked. Now, interestingly, the question was asked through the 20th century. It was asked in the 1940s by somebody called Snyder, who was a physicist who worked with Oppenheimer, and wrote a paper about this in 1947 that was ignored. It was asked, I think, by Schrodinger in an oblique way. It was asked by some mathematicians in England and Poland in a very formal mathematical way in the 1990s. And it really came into discussion. And there is always this thing that it's not the first time the question is asked, but that is remembered. But it's the time that the question is asked that somehow sticks and gets attention. And the attention getter was the same Giovanni Emiliano Camelia in about 2001. And then João Maguejo, and I had a little intervention there, but it was mostly João in the next year. So this is a possibility. And what the interesting thing is that this possibility allows the phenomenon that we've been talking about with photons without violating the principle of the relativity of inertial frames. So it allows the speed of light to become modified with energy in a way that the upcoming experiments could test in a way that doesn't require us to believe that special relativity is wrong and there's a preferred frame of reference. So that's the interesting thing about this. And it's not a quantum theory of gravity, but it's a hypothesis about a quantum theory of gravity very oriented towards experiment. So questions, comments? Yeah. Yes, yes. So that's what I tried, but I obviously didn't do it well. So if you go back to, so let me put it this way. There are now three possibilities for what's the fate of special relativity. So we teach special relativity. What's its fate in a quantum theory of gravity? Okay. What's its fate? How is it going to end up? Okay. Possibility one, special relativity is fine. It's just still true, okay? Which means that there can't be anything like you look at the Planck length and you start to see quantum geometry, because I could just make the Planck length by being a really fast observer out of this piece of chalk. Okay, so that's one possibility. Another possibility is that the relativity principle one, the relativity of inertial frames, is false. So there just is, in other words, special relativity is just false. If you look really small, there's some special discrete structure. Maybe space is really looks like a lattice. Maybe the ether is really true as well. Okay. The third possibility is doubly special relativity. Okay, and so those are three possibilities that the experimentalists are tackling. The interesting thing is that this one would imply that there's no GZK cutoff, okay? But we see a GZK cutoff. So because of that, and because of some other experiments that I don't have time to talk about, this is looking unlikely of the three possibilities. The Auger experiment and several other experiments make it difficult, at least at the scales that we can probe so far, to believe that that the relativity principle is wrong. That is, it could have been disproved by GZK not being there, and it could have been disproved a number of other ways in very, very sensitive atomic physics experiments and nuclear physics experiments. So the possibilities at the present time seem to be between ordinary special relativity and doubly special relativity. And they make different expectations for the speed of light, as is going to be tested in the GLAST experiment and the other experiments with light. Okay. So we actually, if GLAST sees an energy-dependent speed of light, then it will be down here. If GLAST and the other experiments see that even at the order where there could have been even at the order where this effect could have been seen, there is no such effect, then it suggests that at least to leading order, special relativity is fine, at least to leading order in the quantum gravity effects. Okay. So this is a crucial experiment to test basic ideas about quantum gravity, and it's being done now. There was a GLAST satellite launched about a month ago, finally, after years and years and years. And the experiment is presumably going to be done over the next 2 or 3 years. Okay, so let me stop there. Thank you.